Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to remove its online presence from Twitter X.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
On Council's agenda for their Tuesday night meeting, Councillor Connie Glenn and Councillor Lisa Osanek have put forward a motion to cease the city's use of the social media platform X. As of February 1st, 2025, the city turned off replies and direct messaging on the platform for the City of Kingston and Kingston Transit accounts. In the release from the city announcing the change, entitled Prioritizing Positive Communication, Why We're Turning Off Replies on X, the city cited increased numbers of spam accounts following and messaging the city and inflammatory and abusive comments from users on the platform as the reasoning behind the decision. Jen Panarski, Manager of Communications and Public Engagement with the City, had the following to say about the decision in an interview with CFRC shortly after the announcement.
What comments and messages drove this decision, and who or where were they coming from?
So we've been tracking over the last couple of months a lot, big change in user behaviors on X. We think that could be potentially due to changes in the algorithm. We've also seen an increase in spam accounts or bot accounts. So what that ends up happening to our staff is we will receive anywhere up to 1,000 or sometimes 2,000 messages a month on X. And sometimes those aren't very productive conversations. Sometimes we're tagged in something that is like we are in the wrong Kingston, because there's also a Kingston, Jamaica, and there's also a Kingston, London. So we were actually just getting a lot of noise. And so by turning off comments and replies, that helps our staff then redirect their focus on other platforms like Meta, where we have more productive conversations.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're seeing big changes to a lot of social media platforms, including Meta. I was wondering what kind of conversations you're having internally about social media on a larger scale.
No, that's a great question. So social media is by far one of the largest platforms that we have to be able to connect with the community. And we know that people on each of those platforms are all a little bit different. So for example, folks on Meta, they tend to be sort of in a younger demographic versus those on X or other channels tend to be a little bit older. We also use YouTube and emails and newspaper ads to reach a broad demographic. So to answer your question specifically about Meta, we know that there's a lot of changes happening at the policy level on Meta, and we're watching those carefully really to safeguard staff and community members from any non-productive conversations that could happen there.
Mm-hmm. And was it mostly bots and spam that kind of led to this decision, or was it also maybe just comments that weren't productive that were actually from people?
We do, unfortunately, do receive some abuse on social media. We have, you know, humans behind every conversation, and we have a really dedicated social media team. So part of that in protecting the well-being of city staff, that was another reason why we chose to remove replies on X.
Mm-hmm. And you found it was X specifically where you were getting more of these abusive comments compared to other platforms?
I would like to say it's X alone. Sometimes when, as a municipality, we introduce projects or initiatives that the community does not like, for sure, social media is a way that they reach out and let us know that they're unhappy with a decision. We have absolutely mechanisms to try and take in some of that feedback, specifically our public engagement platform. And there's always opportunities for you there to share, you know, your input about a project. We really do try and encourage people to have a positive interaction with us. So sometimes that's just a matter of, you know, encouraging people to read through a project or read through a report before they offer feedback on social media, just so that they have a really full understanding of why we're doing something that we're doing in the municipality.
And did you find when X was Twitter that this was different, or that the landscape was different even a year ago, or was it kind of always building up to this and now was just the time where you said enough is enough?
That's a really good question. So we've been monitoring changes in social media. It's just part of our business practice here in communications and public engagement. We have noticed an escalation or increasing number of spam accounts on X in particular, more so in the last 6 months, last year. X is the platform that was the most disruptive in terms of those fake accounts or spam or abuse. And that's why we chose to turn off replies specifically on X at this time.
The motion being considered by council tonight will take this a step further, completely withdrawing from X. In addition to the reasoning for turning off comments and replies, the motion lists X and the corporation's owner, Elon Musk, as being in conflict with, quote, the municipal values of evidence-based decision-making and diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, as well as a sharp 18% decline in engagement on X in the last few months. Kingston is not the only Canadian municipality having this discussion, with Cambridge and the District of North Vancouver already leaving the platform and many other municipalities considering the move. Should the council vote for the city to exit X entirely, the city will still have other ways of connecting with Kingstonians, including other social media platforms.
So there's always lots of different ways to be able to connect with the city. So our customer experience line, that's actually one of the best ways to try and reach out to the city if you have a question or concern about something. They're able to pick up the phone or respond to a service request. We redid our website in May 2024, and so it's much more user-focused on really that quick information that people are looking for in order to do business or even live and work and play in the city. And we're finding a lot of success in really meeting with community members, going to in-person meetings, our public engagement platform, print, posters in community. So social media has always been one way that we connect with community members. It's never just been the only way. So that's what we try and remind people is municipal government really is one of the most accessible levels of government in Canada. And we're always here. We're always listening.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about local reactions to the Township of Leeds and Thousand Islands' new Indigenous policy.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands has taken another step, albeit cautiously, towards formalizing its approach to Indigenous consultation and land acknowledgement, following a spirited discussion at the April 14th Committee of the Whole meeting. Council reviewed a proposed Indigenous Peoples Relations Consultation and Communications Policy and Land Acknowledgement Statement, both drafted by Arcadis Professional Services Canada Inc., who were hired in 2024. The move aligns with a key pillar in the Township's strategic plan focused on recognizing Indigenous culture and traditional lands. The draft policy stems in part from new requirements under the Provincial Planning Statement 2024, which mandates that municipalities consult with Indigenous communities on matters such as land use planning and cultural heritage. While Council generally supported the land acknowledgement portion of the policy, the more detailed consultation framework prompted mixed views. "This is a different-looking policy from everything that we've done in the past," said Township Chief Administrative Officer Stephen Donaghy. Donaghy acknowledged financial implications tied to consultation fees and pointed to Section 3.5 of the policy that supports informing Indigenous-owned businesses about procurement opportunities. Councillor Angela Kelman spoke in support of the policy's unique tone, noting that it was crafted by Indigenous consultants. Still, some councillors called for caution. Much of the debate was centered around the scope and responsibilities a municipal government has in addressing economic reconciliation. Some, like Councillor Brock Gorrell, noted that they wanted directions from the federal and provincial governments on how to implement policies related to economic reconciliation. In the end, Council did not formally adopt the policy but passed a motion to accept the matter for information only, with staff directed to bring it back when the consultants are available to present and answer questions. And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the CFRC Kingston Sports Report.
After breezing through their first-round series against the Sudbury Wolves, the Kingston Frontenacs advanced to the second round of the OHL playoffs where they played the Barrie Colts. The formerly flawless Fronts found themselves on the back foot early, dropping both games in Barrie by wide margins. Kingston was doubled up by the Colts, getting outscored 13-6 in the opening two games. The Frontenacs flipped the script at home, however. They won a hotly contested Game 3 by a score of 5-3, but it was Game 4 that marked a major turning point for Kingston as their offense exploded for 9 goals, crushing the Colts 9-5. Game 5 was a defensive chess match that saw these normally offensively inclined teams combine for just 2 goals in 60 minutes. Barrie's Kashawn Atkinson would score the deciding goal in overtime to give Barrie the Game 5 victory. Game 6 was played back in the friendly confines of Slush Puppy Place, and it would also require extra frames to decide a winner. Kingston's Gage Hayes scored his second overtime goal of the playoff run to force a Game 7, which was played in Barrie on Tuesday night. After 2 low-scoring affairs, Game 7 was a return to form for these teams. Barrie jumped out to an early lead before the Fronts roared back to make it 4-3 heading into the third. Barrie restored their 2-goal lead before a late goal from Kingston's Kieran Durvin brought the game back to 1. However, Barrie would pot a late empty net goal to hand Kingston a decisive 6-4 loss and take the 7-game series 4-3. This defeat extends Kingston's title drought to 53 seasons, the longest in the OHL.
Thank you, Jesse. And now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with an update on the Amherst View West development.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. A last-minute addition to Council's agenda on Tuesday night saw the Engineering and Environment Department ask for an additional $220,000 in relation to an ongoing development project in Amherst View West. Council approved the extra funds, which will go towards water main and sewer work. The estimated total project cost is now $570,000 compared to the original $350,000 approved last year. Engineering and Environment Manager Luke McDonald admitted the difference in cost came as a surprise to staff, citing the nature of the work. He noted reasons for the miscalculation in their budget process.
It was significantly off, and it's something that we're going to work to address. Nothing changed in the scope of work. We were a little surprised about the cost. We think it's primarily coming down to a few things that we just missed in when we were preparing the estimate. And so it's the nature of the work. So we prepare our cost estimates based on recent tenders that we've completed in past years and imply inflation and stuff like that. But all the recent tenders we've completed in the previous years have been for much larger projects. So you get economies of scale that drives down your unit rates. So that's part of it. And then it's also just our the township's unfamiliarity in recent years of working on county projects for traffic control and things like that. So we're trying to get better at carrying estimates for that as well.
McDonald explained the scope of the work.
Extending the water main primarily at 3 locations, Kildare, Amherst Drive, and Walden Pond, from the existing orientation on the east side of County Road 6 across to the west side. We're also installing a sanitary sewer extension down at the old dance hall properties, what is now the Lakeside Phase 8 subdivision that's under construction. And similarly, that'll be going from the east side to the west side.
McDonald noted with timelines quickly approaching, they're looking to align work with construction the county is currently planning and taking part in.
The intent of the project is working with the county. We identified that they had been planning on doing some surface level reconstruction of County Road 6 from Highway 33 up to the new roundabout. And knowing that these lands for the secondary plan will be serviced in the near future, we identified that it would be preferred to construct these extensions across the road. That would then eliminate the future need for a road cut. It helps extend the life of the county's assets, and obviously it's beneficial from a timing perspective.
Due to regulations, staff and developers have had to repeat testing procedures throughout the process. McDonald explained this was another unexpected cost.
Because we're dealing with not just a smaller scope of work than the other projects, but it's almost four individual project sites. And so what happens is when we're installing the water mains on a larger project, you can kind of commission larger sections of water main. You do your pressure testing, you do your bacteriological testing all together. But in this, because each section is its own, that means we're actually repeating that process a few times. And so that's not reflected in our previous unit rate costs that we got previously, because there's, again, it's economies of scale in that process as well.
McDonald spoke about the bidding process for choosing a company to work with and how the costs affected their overall budget.
We have a existing roster that we use of pre-approved contractors that have been screened for work experience, health and safety, and various criteria. So this project was posted to that roster for bids. We received six bids following that process, and Mulrooney was identified as the low bid, and then therefore are the preferred proponent. The low tender price was $468,000. So once we add in contingency, staff time, and those various items, we come up with a required project cost of $570,000 compared to the approved budget of $350,000.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the screening of We Are Still Here at a Port Hope Church.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. The continuation of reconciliation and discussion of Canada's residential school system will take place in Port Hope May 1st with the screening of a documentary detailing the experiences of three Indigenous women. Mary Alderson with the United Church in Port Hope says these talks were important on educating the non-Indigenous population as to what occurred at the church-run, government-funded schools.
Well, it's something very near and dear to my heart. It was produced by the London Conference of the United Church of Canada down in southwestern Ontario, where I used to live. And I actually got to know one of the women that is featured in the film before the film was made. And so to see her up there was really exciting. When I was living in that part of Ontario, I was actually in the village of Grand Bend, where I was a member of the United Church there too. And we had what we called a right relations group, where we were working towards right relations with the Indigenous people. And we got to know this Geraldine Robertson was her name. A lovely lady. She was in her 80s, and she had lived at two residential schools. First, she had been sent to the Mount Elgin School on Muncie Reserve near London, and she was there 2 years. And then they built a new school on her reserve, so she got to go home again. And she was from the Sarnia Reserve, which is now called Omgenon. But when she got back there, sadly, her parents got tuberculosis and her father died and her mother was very ill. And so the Indian agent, who was regularly rounded up kids on the reserve and sent them to residential schools, took her and her younger sister, maybe two younger sisters, and they were put on a train to the Mohawk Institute. Yeah. Yes. Her time there was horrible. She was sent in to the principal for straps, and she said this was a minister of the church, and he took delight in strapping them until their hands bled. And she said, according to the residential school rules, he was only supposed to strap each hand two times. Well, he would keep it up and keep it up and keep it up, and her hands would be raw and bleeding by the time he was finished. And she heard whispers from the boys, although the boys and the girls were separated. Girls that had brothers were not allowed to speak to them. Still, the whispers got through the school that they were being molested. They didn't know the name for it at the time or what was going on, but they knew enough to know it wasn't right and it wasn't wanted. The food was awful. The kids were at the first school she was at, she said, the kids were made to work on farms that they had where they grew lovely fresh vegetables, and yet they never got to eat them. They were served porridge, watery porridge, oatmeal, three times a day. And the schools were known as the mush holes because that's all they ate.
Why is the United Church in Port Hope screening the film now, 10 years after the final report came out from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, there's still much to be done. There were, I believe it's 98, 94 conclusions in that report. Not very many of them have been accomplished yet.
What are you hoping for comes following the screening of the film?
Two things. Our Truth and Reconciliation Committee, we have developed a friendship with Alderville United Church. We have visited their church. They have visited our church. And Lisa McDonald, a counselor from Alderville, has opened up the doors of communication, and we have developed a very nice friendship with them. So we don't expect them to be at the screening. For many who have experienced residential schools or their parents experienced residential schools, because it is generational trauma, they prefer not to talk about it. And that was always the problem, is that once they got out of residential schools, it was so horrible they didn't want to talk about it. The same way if you run into war veterans, they don't want to tell you the stories because it was just so awful. They don't want to relive that. So we're not necessarily, we have notified them that we're doing this and we have invited them, but we also understand if they don't want to come, that's fine. It's to open the eyes of the non-Native population in the community and in Canada, that these are very real problems. And also in the video, they talk about the generational problems. It's, you know, you can say, oh, well, we closed the schools, the problem's gone. No, it goes down through the generations. If parents don't know how to be parents because they were never parented, they can't be good parents to their kids, and so on and so on and so on.
So some people may say, and this has been going on since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings were taking place in the early to mid-2000s, that the church get involved at this level. The churches, to some degree, were very responsible for the treatment of some. Now, I realize that some churches have been a little more progressive in addressing residential schools, having the tough discussions. But some people will say, why is the church still getting involved in a really discussion that maybe should be led by Indigenous people?
Well, we certainly wouldn't hold a discussion without their involvement. I mean, we have invited them. They have come. We've made some good friends there. I will be able to count Lisa McDonald as one of my longtime friends now. We've been back and forth for the past year or two, and, you know, it's been good. So that is important. But I think it's also important to still keep educating our non-Native population, the rest of the country. Just because I hear things people said, you're still worrying about that? Come on, it's all done, it's over with. No, it's not. There's still horrific racism out there, and anything we can do to overcome that, we would like to help in it.
And just a bit of back history, I covered the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the Yukon from 06 to 2017. So I went through all the whole layers, the national events. One of the things I noticed and this was at the national event in Inuvik in 2010, that I really noticed was that the United Church was taking more of a proactive stance. They came out early. They said, yes, we recognize what we did. We owned our responsibility, our role in this. What, I guess, have you seen since this whole experience has begun and the transition through reconciliation? What have you seen the church accomplish in that time, since say maybe in the last 15 years?
Well, I think doors have been opened, just as we have done here in Port Hope with Alderville. It's maybe it doesn't look like a lot, but it certainly feels like a lot to me. I grew up next door to Kettle and Stony Point and lived there when Dudley George was shot. So I remember the horrible times we went through at that point in our history here in Ontario. And so fortunately, I could count some friends among the Indigenous people there on that First Nation. And I can see the value in, keeping the doors open.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, April 24th, we are going to see temperatures into the mid-teens with a daytime high of 15 degrees and a 30% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, April 25th, it'll be cloudy but dry with a daytime high of 15 degrees, dropping down to 8 overnight with a 60% chance of precipitation. Saturday, April 26th, a little cooler, a little more rainy, high of 12 with a 40% chance of showers, dropping down to about 6 degrees overnight. Moving into Sunday, April 27th, we're going to have a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14 and it will be sunny. And then starting the next week, Monday, April 28th, it'll be 14 and cloudy. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians on the following dates. Saturday, May 3rd from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday, May 17th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Saturday, May 31st from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. During these periods, the removal of the modular bridge will begin at 6 a.m., with the marine channel expected to be open by 9 a.m. The marine channel will be closed at 5 p.m. to reinstall the bridge. The causeway is expected to reopen to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians by 8 p.m. Here are some road closures to be aware of. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Demare Street, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill is closed from April 22nd to May 2nd for servicing works. Russell Street, Patrick to Kent is closed April 23rd and 24th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for sanitary sewer line repairs. Victoria Street, Union Street to Johnson Street is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other relevant delays. Accommodation Road, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work around the newly installed culvert at the north end of Accommodation Road. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving and signage to improve safety and efficiency, and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.